Guess what?
What?
No more homework.
What, having to read?
No more homework.
Yes.
Yes.
It wasn't that arduous.
Says the man who did absolutely no post-production whatsoever.
For 7 years?
Yeah.
No, I did nothing. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, the final episode.
Episode 68.
Yeah.
It still doesn't ring. It's not a good final episode. No,
we probably should have gone until February.
Yeah.
We're not doing that.
It might be two more special episodes, though, at some point. But final for now.
I love how you throw that in without having chatted with me. You just assume, what?
Continue the introduction.
No, that is the introduction.
Because it's no longer a bi-monthly podcast.
Or a monthly podcast. With, yeah, I mean, what's the...
The stuff. The books. Yeah. The books, the reading, the stuff.
So we just had a look.
Hello, everyone. I'm Kirsten.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Oh, yeah, hi. Hi, Kirsten. Well, why introduce you on the final episode?
People may have just tuned in. They'll be so disappointed, but they'll have
hey, just well, tuned in. if they have just tuned in...
They've got 7 years of episodes.
Yes, the first one was recorded in November 2010. Do you remember 2010?
Yeah, I would. Yeah,
seriously, it vaguely. Feels about 500 years ago.
That we started the podcast?
No.
Or 2010?
It's funny now, but when you look at 2010, you think...
It was more innocent times.
Really, it was. And yet, it's probably not, but it was.
It was more innocent times back then. Oh, yeah.
Just think what's happened in the last 7 years while we've been doing this podcast.
I really don't want to think about what's... Maybe it's our fault.
I think it is. That's
maybe,
why
maybe starting the podcast began the descent into the darkest timeline. Somehow.
And you notice that the moment we said we're finishing, Patreon itself fucked up.
But they've fixed it.
I know they're fixing it. But still, you know, just all these dominoes just collapsed in a heap.
Yeah, that okay.
The moment we said we're done. And we apologise.
You think a lot of your little world, don't you?
I do. Well, I am the centre of it, yes. So, you know. And we do apologise that this is a month late.
Yes, we had, there was an unavoidable conflict that arose at the last minute, so we had
was
to
that
postpone.
My conflict or your conflict?
That was yours. That's why we're recording in a hotel now, because we had to fit the podcast into crazy December that we normally don't record in December, because we can't find a time to do it, so.
We nearly didn't find a time.
We nearly didn't find a time.
Because you know what I booked for today?
Oh, what?
The car service. I forgot. As it happened, it was serviced a week ago because it was so rooted. It needed to be serviced. Couldn't wait till today. So,
it was an emergency.
Yeah. The air conditioner wasn't working.
Oh, that is an emergency.
Yeah, this is just pure podcast gold.
It's better than weather. This Hi, Galactic Suburbia. Okay, so.
So what are the final two books for the final episode of the final Writer and the Critic?
Maybe asterisk.
Maybe asterisk.
Or should there be asterisk? Maybe, yeah. Okay, so as we said last month, it's an interesting one. We're doing two debut novels by the same person.
Thus, it's impossible.
No, it's not impossible. Here's why it's possible.
Okay.
So... my friend, full disclosure, I know Bren quite well and have for many years. Bren McDibble published two books last year, one of them under her name, Bren McDibble, which was How to Be, and that was published by Allen and Unwin.
Yes.
And that was actually published first. This came out in June, because yes. I remember she had a launch at Continuum. And then In the Dark Spaces by Callie Black, which is Bren's pseudonym, was published a couple of months later. But it's important to say that In the Dark Spaces was contracted first because it won the Ampersand Prize, which is a prize for unpublished novelists. So even though another book came out first in the end, In the Dark Spaces was actually won the Ampersand Prize and was contracted while Bren had not had another book contracted or published.
Sounds like there might have been some corruption going on.
It wasn't corruption. It was just.
Will
that,
there be a royal inquiry into this?
A royal commission?
Yes, that thing.
Sure, into Bren McDibble.
Yes, and her pseudonym.
I think that would be a good use of taxpayer money.
Do you know why she chose Callie Black? I'm always interested in pseudonyms.
The actual name?
Yes. No. Yes. No, actually, I'm not.
I think she just liked the name.
And yet, you're good friends.
But she chose. I can tell you why she chose a pseudonym.
Okay.
Because Bren has, even though these are her first two novels, she's published several chapbooks and short fiction over the years for children, for the age group that How to Be is aimed at, which is sort of the 7 to 12 kind of, 12 is probably a bit too old, but you know, the sort of preteen, what our American friends would call the middle grade readers. So she's known as an author of chapbooks and things like that, and How to Be is in that vein, in the sense of the age group and so on. Whereas In the Dark Spaces, as you would have realised, Ian, reading it, is fucking terrifying and savage.
I would say How to Be is pretty terrifying and savage.
But just in terms of the things that happen in
there's more on-screen violence.
It is for an older readership.
No, I would argue that they're actually both very similar in that sense, but there's more on-screen violence.
Yes.
It's more graphic.
Yes,
is the word you're looking for.
So Bren and the publisher of In the Dark Spaces, which is Hardy Grant Egmont, who sponsored the Ampersand Prize. They didn't want to take the younger readers who had found her through How to Be or her other chapbooks and thought, oh, this is a Bren McNipper book, we'll read it and then get traumatised for a while. So she's published In the Dark Spaces under a pseudonym for that reason. So she doesn't tell her younger readers that it's around. She's quite happy to talk about it for adult readership. So if you're under 10,
except
and you're listening,
it's not an adult novel. It's a young adult novel.
No, her at young adult and adult
okay,
readership.
Gotcha.
So just pointing out that we have an adult podcast. So if you are under 10, go away. Come back. Look at the time code I'm going to put in the show notes and just skip the Kelly Black one. That's why she chose this pseudonym,
okay,
because the tone and the age group of the two books are quite different, and because How to Be and some of her other chat books are for a markedly younger readership, and they didn't want to throw In the Dark Spaces at them just yet.
I'm
It's pretty harsh.
Okay, first off,
it's clearly not for readers under 10, I think.
I'm not sure it is How to Be. I mean, okay, first off.
Yes. So which one are we going to talk about first?
I think we should talk about How to Be first.
Okay.
But can I just say,
yes,
just on covers,
yes,
I love the cover for How to Be.
Yes.
I do not like the cover for In the Dark Spaces. I think it's actually a very nice cover. I just don't think it's evocative of the book at all.
I will point out that In the Dark Spaces is the first science fiction / spec fic novel to have won the Ampersand Prize, which is generally a more lit fic thing. So I don't know if that has an influence on the type of covers that the publisher is producing. They clearly didn't want to go for one with an alien and a spaceship.
Well, that's the thing. We'll talk about it more in detail, but it is a full-bore space opera.
It is.
And it looks like not that.
Yeah, exactly. It is covering.
Well,
I assume
that pattern there is the wings of the crow people. You know, that's.
Oh, I didn't see that.
I suppose that's what that's meant to be.
See,
sort of feathers.
I looked at that as the hive. Did you say feathers?
Yes.
Oh, we'll come back to this. Okay, but first, we'll come back to it.
All right,
we'll come back to it.
Can I just say I read these books a month ago because I assumed we were doing the podcast.
Yes, me too. So, I read them 2 months ago. So.
Okay, so this will be, as usual, a well-prepared, fantastic episode of Writer.
No, because I love both these books. Spoilers. So, yes.
Oh, I haven't said what I think of them.
Oh, I don't care.
And have you ever?
So, How to Be. Shall I just read the back copy?
Why do anything different?
Okay. In a world where real bees are extinct.
In a world where real bees are extinct.
So it's very near future then. The quickest, bravest kids climb the fruit trees and pollinate the flowers by hand. All Peony really wants is to be a bee, dancing along the high branches and helping her gramps and sister scratch out a living. Life on the farm is a scrabble, but there is enough to eat and a place to sleep, and there is love. Then Peony's mother arrives to take her away from everything she's ever known. Will Peony's grit and quick thinking be enough to keep her safe? It's nice. It's a nice little opening without giving too much of the book away.
That's a very good blurb.
Yeah, it is.
But let's unpack. So you said you're making this point that, yes, this is for 8 to 12, middle grade. I don't understand these distinctions anymore because, I don't know. I mean, I always keep coming back to Zed for Zachariah.
That scarred you.
It did.
That book scarred you so terribly. What would
that be considered? What, that would probably now be considered middle grade, wouldn't it? Because we read it in year 9, year 10 when we were 14, 15.
I don't know. I think it's really... It's
although
really,
it does have sex in it.
It's really hard distinctions to make because... the type of like writing has changed. The sophistication of writing has changed.
Can I explain why?
So you can't. It's hard to backdate books and go, "Well, this would be YA now, or this would not be YA now," because you just can't do that. It's
no. But the reason I'm dragging us back to Z for Zachariah for I don't know. It feels like I've done it every podcast.
I know. Like, you should be in therapy for that book. I think. Tell me where the book touched you, Ian.
Is because How to Be is got domestic violence in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a world that's suffering, well, has suffered a famine where pollination doesn't, the bees are, it's not, are they extinct completely?
They're not extinct, but they're, because, spoilers, at the end, there are bees that are brought to the farm.
Yes, that's right.
To try to, so they're not extinct, but they're certainly not common. They're not. Yes. They're not around anymore.
It's a pretty miserable, I mean, Peony lives in a tin shed. Yeah, she likes her life in a tin shed, but it is a tin shed.
I think. Though what
and
what,
they seem to be, you know, slaves.
They're practically indentured servants.
Yeah,
they can't
like a sharecropper slave type arrangement.
Yeah, they're on the farm, and they're, you know, they're given room and board, and the particular overseer on this farm appears to be quite a nice guy.
But you
get the impression that certainly, and it wouldn't be a given. There'd be some. People, and he's not the owner of the farm, he's just the manager, right?
Yeah.
So and the owner of the farm clearly doesn't care about paying his people a living wage, so they
So medicine is scarce, medicine is scarce, and when we get to the Big Smoke,
yeah,
it's a shithole. I mean, unless you're in a gated community, yeah. Where
does this all sound familiar?
Well, I'm
like
saying,
it's a small step.
I suppose, and I've got this completely wrong, I know, but I suppose 10-year-olds, they just eat that shit up. I mean, that's...
No, I think what it is we...
As I have a 7-year-old, I probably need
to know. Like we bring to these books and both these books a lot more information about the world and life experience and stuff that we read into it. I mean, if you're 8 to 10, you just don't know stuff. You've not experienced stuff, right? So much in the way that Peony in this book, and I think this is one of... Because both of these books are written in the first person, and I know Bren / Kelly, I'm just going to call her Bren because it's weird. I know Bren worked really, really hard in the last few years developing voice and using voice, and both of these books have two very distinctive voices, and she's done a really good job. And part of what's so compelling and readable about How to Be is Peony, because she is this young kid, and... You're in the world. This is your world, and you don't know about Marxist philosophy, and you don't know about, you know, class systems and all this shit. This is just your life. So you live your life, and this is what Peony does. And I think a lot of the kids, certainly by no means all, there are a lot of kids out there who have a lot of life experience that we'd wish they didn't. But you know, it's just what life is. And it's only as you get older and get more experience and start to view the world in more sophisticated ways that you can overlay a lot of stuff here. And I think much younger readers are, they're just more inclined to take things at face. This is the world. This is the world. All right. So I think we bring a lot more horror to this book as adults,
I think,
than the children who are reading it at the age that Peony is.
I think it speaks volumes of my own coddled life that I find this terribly disturbing, this book.
It is disturbing, but I think we bring a lot of that as adults. I don't necessarily think... in fact, Bren has done around and has gone around and done a lot of like library talks and school talks and stuff for How to Be. And the kids are really... nonplussed by a lot of it. They're not like everything is wonderful, but they're not like traumatized by it all. Except there was a really interesting thing that she told me. She's done talks in Melbourne in city schools, but she's also gone out to regional places like Castlemaine and done talks. And she's saying again, spoilers, the kids in the regions not so upset about the mother dying. The kids in the city are like, why did you kill the mother? That was awful. The kids in the the bush are like, we get it. Yeah. There's this little shift in the sense of, the different type of life you have.
I think, though, you're right. Yeah. The voice is extraordinary. I mean,
it's really good.
It's a fantastic novel. No bones there. It is really, really good. And the world building is very subtle but smart.
I'm just going to read, actually, because just to give you a sense, I'm just going to read the first paragraph, actually, just to give you an idea of the voice. Today, it's here, bright and real and waiting. The knowing of it bursts into my head so big and sudden like the crack of morning sun bursting through the gap at the top of the door. I fall out of my bunk and hit the packing box floor. I scramble up, right into Gramps asleep in his chair in front of the potbelly stove. Char, he growls. Sorry, Gramps, I say, it's B-Day. I pull on my pest vest and try to squeeze past him, but he holds his foot. First eat, then B, he says, real firm. He cuts a wedge from the oatcake on top of the stove. Cockies screech loud from the tree over our shack. They know it's time to get moving. I can't, I say, and try to squeeze past again. Foreman's waiting. My sister Magnolia sticks her fluffy head out from the top bunk. Stomp yourself, peony pest, she groans. You won't diss me when I'm a bee, I say. Like, it's a lovely voice.
It's its own language.
It's a voice that pulls you through the book. She peony greets everything in the world with fascination, I think.
Does she though? Because when she gets to the city, she's quite angry.
Yeah, but
she's like been kidnapped essentially by her mother.
My mother, yeah. But all of the things that she sees, she's like she looks at everything. You know, she notices everything. She's wonderful. She's a wonderful character to view the world through.
So I was saying that.
Sorry. Yes.
The world building is very subtle, but smart. I mean, we should probably speak a little bit about the bees and the fact that, this is a real concern.
The
extinction of our bee population.
Yep.
Although I was listening to a podcast and bees that have the husbandry bees, actually their numbers are rising, but bees in the wild, their numbers are collapsing. So what it means is that the variety of bees out there is shrinking.
Yes.
So we have a lot more of the same bee, but not the variety.
Which is a huge problem.
Massive problem. And yes, bees are probably, you know, the best pollinator out there. Other things pollinate, not just bees, but they do the best job of it. And without pollination, we're fucked. We're not, though. We're not completely fucked. It's not complete Armageddon.
No, well,
But it's not great, though.
So there was I'm going to be quite vague about the facts because I just can't remember. But there was a region in China a few years ago that, and I cannot now remember why, so I'm not going to guess, but there was something that happened and all the bees went. They were just killed. But it was either, you know, pesticides or gas. Like something happened. And they actually got people to be bees. They got people to pollinate, not little children, but they got people to pollinate the fruit-bearing trees for a few years. And what they found out is bees are not that efficient. Bees are actually not that efficient in their pollination.
Well, humans can do it better.
Humans can do it much better. They were getting bigger crops.
Are you shitting me?
No, because humans, bees just flutter around and they do what they do. Humans go every single blossom, right? But, of course, you've got to pay humans. We get the bees for free. So there's, you know, it's a trade-off. The bees just wander around and do their stuff. And we plant stuff and they pollinate it and everyone's happy. And it's a wonderful symbiotic relationship.
What we should do is say, because bees are dying off for multiple reasons. It's not one variable. It is climate change. It's pesticides, as you said.
It's definitely pesticides.
But it's all those things. It's not just one of them. So what you're saying is fuck it. Don't worry about the bees.
No,
if we want to find jobs for people, make them bees.
Sure. And then our food gets really expensive because you're paying people to do a job that the bees did for free.
Yes.
And the bigger, the more abundant crops does not counter the fact that you need to pay people a living wage. Hopefully,
wage. But you know, like Black Mirror did it. You know what?
Drones.
Yeah. You saw the Black Mirror episode?
I did see the Black Mirror episode, yes.
And that's what will happen. It'll become robotic. Because we're not seeming to. And part of what this book does, it says it's quite pessimistic.
But drones aren't free either. And the resources to make drones aren't free.
I get that. But.
Like bees do it for free. This is the thing. We've had these wonderful workers.
I know. I'm saying that this is quite a pessimistic book in that sense, because the ecological message is actually not. Yes, it does have that slight hope at the end, but it does say, well, actually, we fucked ourselves because we didn't see this as a warning sign.
See, is that
signs.
Pessimistic or is that realistic?
Okay. You probably, yeah, the
second. Because I'm thinking that's realistic.
Well, it's what I'm hearing now, and I know I'm not necessarily talking about the book as much, although it's the catalyst, is people are saying, oh, you know, we're fucked, but we'll science our way out of it anyway, so don't worry about it. And that to me is the wrong fucking message.
No, it's not that.
Let's not keep digging up coal because
when we say we,
I'm talking
what
about
we mean is them in the future.
But like, it's not 100 years from now.
But this is a problem. I had a conversation with someone, and he was playing devil's advocate. He was, but I had a conversation.
So name him.
No, I won't. A couple of weeks ago at dinner with someone, he was saying, you know, it's like if. Like, here's the thing, if we're fucked, like, if we appear to be, in the sense of we are not going to retain the standards of living that we currently have, in the West, asterisk, asterisk, fucking asterisk, because there's huge parts of the world and millions of people in the world who are already living in what billions. We would consider post-apocalyptic conditions in terms of hygiene and ability to access fresh water and abundant food and all of that sort of stuff.
Yes.
So this is not like we're all doing great on planet Earth here. We're not. And a lot of that is our, asterisk, asterisk, actually our fault. So anyway, step off the soapbox. But the conversation kind of went like, well, if we're fucked, as in humans, like if it's done and we can't come back and it's all and it appears to be the case, then ethically, shouldn't we just continue to live as comfortably as we can for as long as we can until it's done? Like, is it worth then, you know, trying to lower our standards of living if it's all fucked anyway? And I mean, the answer is no, of course not, because the metaphor for that is like having a party. And when all the alcohol is drunk and all the money runs out, you go home.
Well, that's having a party.
But we can't go home. Like, yeah. We can't go home. And there's never going to be an end. There's not going to be a sudden end, right? Yeah. So whoever is left when we finish our living until we just can't live like this anymore is just going to be in the worst state ever. Like, it's not just going to sudden end. No one turns off a switch, you know, unless a meteor hits the planet or something. But even then, it's not going to end. There's always going to be.
No, but there could be an extinction event, though.
Of course, yeah. But
well, that's the whole argument. That's what we're moving towards. The fifth extinction or whatever, whichever number extinction
yeah,
is.
Yeah, absolutely. But that doesn't mean that, like, immediately there's a switch flicked and life
no,
has ended.
It's like anything.
Like, there's always going to be a long tail.
There's the death throes.
Yeah, exactly. But also to make that decision now without all knowledge available.
No, it's selfish, indulgent, yeah. And actually pretty cold and heartless if you're someone who's had kids. Because what you're basically saying is, because the whole point of, you know, having children to an extent, because they can drive you mad, is creating a better life for them. But what you're basically saying is, I'll take the inheritance. You can have the dregs.
Isn't that what like current generations are doing right now?
Well, the baby boomers are.
What's the word? There's a little acronym. Ski people spending the kids' inheritance. So yes, all of the baby boomers who are retiring now and go, oh fuck, leaving anything for the kids. We're just gonna spend every dollar we have till we die.
Yes,
which is fine. It's their right, clearly, but you know, it's also like,
I'm going to guess that when Bren went to those schools, they weren't talking about skis and and people's
probably
inheritance.
Not.
They were probably talking about Peony's relationship with Esmeralda.
They also talk about the bees. Like the kids are not. You don't wrap them in cotton wool. You talk about the bees. You talk about the fact that the bees are dying. You talk about
that if I was at school,
there's food
and
problems.
Someone came in as a 10-year-old listening to that about the bees, I'd be nightmares for weeks, months. I'd still be having them now. I'd feel in my 40s. I don't know. Kids must be
Zed
just
for Zechariah.
Yeah, I tell you, it really does come to that. But anyway, yeah. Talking about Peony and Esmeralda. Because I think we should probably talk about the book to some extent.
Yes, we should. We should.
Right. Although the discussions we're having are because of the book.
Yes, absolutely.
As is always the case. Yes, anyway, so.
So Peony does get taken to the city by her mother because her mother wants. Her mother genuinely does want one of her daughters with her. She doesn't take Magnolia because Magnolia has kind of a disability.
She's disabled.
We're not told exactly what that is, but she does have a disability. And the reason we're not told exactly what it is, because again, it's through Peony's eyes, and that's just a sister.
Yeah.
Right? So she doesn't see her sister as a person with a disability. So we're not given, you know, this detailed medical history or anything. But that's why the mother doesn't take Magnolia, because she also needs someone to help with the work. She can't just take a kid who's going to do nothing. She's got to take a kid who'll also work in the house where she works, because she's a servant slash kitchen hand slash everything in this rich person's mansion in the city. So she goes and gets Peony and takes her, even though she doesn't want to go.
And that's a pretty harrowing scene on its own.
It is, because Peony runs away and hides.
And the mother, she fails taking her the first time around, the first attempt, but also at the same time, the mother's treatment of her other daughter, Magnolia, is fucking awful. I mean, there's no other way of putting it.
She's not a nice person, the mother.
No, she's not. But once they get to the city, her edges are softened to an extent.
I think
you begin to see that there are outside forces that are pushing her way that she's...
That's it. I mean, because she's in an abusive relationship with a man who's not either of the girls' father.
And it's called the Ape.
Peony calls him the Ape. I think, again, this is a filter that we bring as adults. And we can kind of see the stuff which... I mean, she's a woman in survival
mode.
But
I don't think she is, because I think she has pride for her daughter.
She does. But she is a woman in survival mode, and that is what is pushing most of her decisions.
Yes.
Like, including the decision to be in this abusive relationship.
And to stay in it.
And to stay in it. As, you know, as a lot of women who are in abusive relationships are, they're in survival mode.
Because we should say that we find out that she's pregnant as well.
Yes. It's easy for us as adults to look at the mother's whole situation, and even though she does, some of her actions are deplorable, we can see the forces that are curtailing her and pushing her in directions.
And therefore,
completely out of
all
her control.
Good fiction, whether it's for 10-year-olds or 30-year-olds or whatever, it has layers. This is the thing. It's not just about us bringing our experience. It's all in the book. It's not like we have to overlay huge amounts. It's all in the text.
Yeah, her case is really, really sad.
And McDibble does the same with Esmeralda, that, you know, you would say this is a privileged, rich, spoiled brat.
And
that's how Peony views her, and that's because that's what she is.
Yes.
But she's also agoraphobic.
Yeah, and she's also just a kid.
And just a kid.
So she's young enough to maybe to maybe reach and say, hey.
And you could say her parents are privileged, blah, 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 wealthy, narrow-minded, blinkered. And they are. But they're also parents who love their child.
Yeah. And they're not...
But that's what the book does constantly. Yeah. It constantly doesn't just go the easy route. Yeah. It does tip those expectations over just a little bit.
And with all the the characters in the book, they're, as you say, they're all there's a complexity to them, and there's no mustache twirling villains here. I mean, it would have been so easy.
Well, the Ape is the closest you get.
He is, and even he does
the right thing in the end. In that
the selfish thing.
Well, yeah, because he calls the child an it, doesn't he?
He does. Right. He does the right thing because he's doing a selfish thing. Right?
You could argue. He could have just, he's buried the mum. He just buries the kid. And, you know, that was my...
Oh, he's just going to kill the baby.
He could.
That's quite a step. That's quite a fucking
I don't know.
Step.
The Ape is not a great character. He's
not
a great person.
Step, but, you know, I think that there is... That's a big step.
Would anyone have known?
No, but that is why would he even do that? Is it easy just to take the kid away? Okay, in terms of fiction, yes, it's quite easy. Like, in terms of how people work, that's a massive step to kill your own infant child.
Yeah, possibly.
Right?
He describes the child as an it, so...
He does, but how much of that is just self-distancing so he can get rid of it?
Well, how much self-distancing...
You know what I mean?
How much self-distancing do you need to break the kid's neck and just dump the body somewhere?
I don't know. Could you kill a baby?
No, of course not, but I'm also not in an abusive relationship with my wife.
Yeah, but then...
Now this is the last episode. We don't have to follow that up.
This is what McDibble does with these characters, is they're not, like, she doesn't just make them black and white extreme versions
of
something.
No, I agree. I absolutely agree with you. I just think, the Ape is not the black mark on the novel.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that, I am saying he does, I'm the one who said he does do the right thing, for selfish reasons at the end.
Yeah.
You could make an argument that he could have.
Just kill the baby.
Just kill the baby. Or even, okay, fine, you don't want to kill the baby, fine. Found somewhere else for the baby to live. Just dump the baby somewhere else, not necessarily with this family, because he knows they hate him.
Yeah, but they're not going to hate the baby. It's Pernie's little brother. Is anyway. It brother or was it a little boy or a little girl? I can't remember now. Ah, anyway, baby, they're all the same. We don't know yet, not until they're old enough to talk. whether they're a boy or a girl.
Okay.
Or neither.
But yes, going off to, yes, there are no real villains other than society in general causing the state of affairs that people are in the book.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the strengths of the book because you kind of gear yourself up to dislike Esmeralda and certainly to dislike her parents. They must be awful. And then there are these little touches that come in and you go, okay, so then they're not awful people, like intrinsically, they're really wealthy and they're rich and they're quite blind to a lot of the inequality, or they just don't care, which is awful. But it's, you know what I mean? They're not like, it's not like they're just terrible human beings. So it's quite fascinating.
If you're taking a pure Marxist interpretation of the book, you know, you said Marxist philosophy before. If you're taking a pure Marxist view, you'd say, yes, but aren't we normalising the rich people?
Sure. But I don't.
Because they don't improve by the end of this book. It's not like their lives are going to change. It's not like.
No.
I mean, the one flourish is that. When Ez comes to visit the farm, you know, she knows Peony's there and there's a, you know, they like each other and there's a wave of the hand, that sort of thing. You think, well, it's still, Peony's life hasn't radically improved because she now knows, which I like actually about the book.
Yes.
Because the worst thing that could have been done is that Peony now is in
gets whisked away into the city and her family gets whisked away with her and they're all doing well, but it hasn't changed anything.
Correct.
No, I like the fact that it hasn't changed anything. And I think that's what, all of this, the stuff that you critique around the book is around the book because Peony can't do anything. Peony can't change the world. Like, it would be ludicrous if that's what happened because it would, like, as I said, it would elide the fact that, okay, that family's okay now, but what about everyone else? You know, so the fact that she's still in the world that she's in, so it's kind of up to the reader to bring that. And say, yeah, it is fucked. It is fucked. Like in Peony's story, it has an optimistic ending, and there's, you know, she is okay, in the sense that she's not okay in terms she's
still
of her
living
life.
She's still living in a tin shed at the end of the story.
Yeah, but she's back where she wants to be. Like she's quite happy. And I don't know. You can kind of think, well, maybe when Esmeralda gets older, maybe she'll be one of the people who agitates for change, or maybe not. Maybe she'll just remain in her comfortable life. You don't know. Like, there's all these ripple effects that might go out. But I would have disliked the book if the rich family had just been these evil moustache twirling villains. And you know, because like when it comes right down to it, and it's a really discomforting thought to contain. But when it comes right down to it, I think most people in whatever class structure they're in are not awful people. This is just how it is. Like for everybody, this is just how it is. So if you're really wealthy, this is just how it is. And all those other people mustn't, you know, work hard enough, be good enough, be worthy enough or whatever to be rich. But it's certainly not that you're evil and doing bad things. I mean,
unless you are actually evil and doing bad things.
Yeah, but for most people, I mean, this is just the way it is. And that's what makes it so difficult to change. Like you only have to have any conversation about, you know, racism or privilege or class structures with just about any person in the world to start feeling pushback. Well, I'm not like that. I didn't get given anything. I worked for what I got. And of course they worked. Of course they worked, most of them. Some didn't. Some got an inheritance and haven't done a day's work in their life. But most people have worked. They just, you know, it's hard to see outside. I mean, you and I are privileged compared to a huge number of people just in Australia, let alone the rest of the world. And it is like it's discomforting to be told that you have stuff you didn't earn, because we all want to think we earned what we have. And we didn't. We didn't earn what we have. None of us did. You know, we have worked, we have contributed, we've done whatever we had. But there's no, at base level, where what we have is what we have earned and no more or no less. But it's really uncomfortable conversations to have. And you have to have them to dismantle the capitalist corporate oligarchy.
So is that what Bren wants 11-year-olds to get out of this book? The dismantling of the capitalist oligarchy?
I think she does, because poverty, issues of poverty and class are actually really important to her. So I think she does, actually. Like, it's not didactic, it's not there, but it's just showing.
No, okay, but here's the question. What does Bryn think?
I don't mean that.
No. Actually, Milad, I will rephrase that question. But do we leave this book thinking that Peone's life is appropriate? Is the way it should be? I mean, she thinks it is because this is all she knows.
Yep.
But is this what we want for Peone ultimately into the future, and for everyone else at the farm?
I didn't think that. I don't know what a 10-year-old might think. I don't know if a 10-year-old might sympathise more with Peone and the idea of just living on a farm and running around every day is preferable.
Because Peone, to an extent, is romanticising this life.
Yeah.
Because it's all she knows.
Yeah.
And that is the discomforting question at the end.
Yeah.
Is she romanticising a state of affairs that really, fuck, that's hot. She's living in a tin shed. I keep going back to that.
But let's not forget also, I mean, the other thing in this book.
There's no medicine. I mean, people could.
Well, he's like Apple Joe's mother dies. Apple Joe is Peone's best friend on the farm. And he's also, he's a kid and he's got siblings and a sick mother. And then at the end of the book, Applejoe's mother dies because she's just sick and then there's no proper medical treatment and she just dies. In fact, my only objections to both these books collectively is all the dead mothers. Like, they're just full of dead mothers. This is a greater cultural thing. We like our dead mothers. We do like our dead mothers in our culture, in our fiction. And
dead mothers,
like,
and missing fathers.
Dead mothers and missing fathers, that's what we do. We like our dead mothers and our missing fathers.
Because they are missing the fathers.
And it's really fucked. And it's not just these two books. As I said, it's a wider thing. But these two books are another, you know, drop in that very big bucket of the dead mother bucket.
I don't think it's the intent of the book to romanticise the lifestyle on the farm.
No, and I don't think it is. I think you have to separate Peone's viewpoint with the facts of the case.
Yeah.
And I think children are sophisticated enough to be able to go, you know, it's not that great. Because let's face it, this is Peone's life and this is the only life she knows. And even with her brief exposure to the city, and which she only sees through bus windows and car windows.
And she never adapts to it, we should
know. No, she never adapts to it. But the readers of this book largely are not kids like Peone. They're kids who have, you know, access to televisions and iPads and computers and the internet and a number of devices and toys and good clothing and, you know, medicine when they have a cold and all this sort of stuff. And I think even, you know, 8 to 10-year-olds are sophisticated enough to transpose what they would not have if they had Peone's life. And I don't think, like, what we're doing, you know, we're saying this is terrible because look what these people don't have. And I think children are sophisticated enough to do that. So I think as much as Peone is self-pragmatizes more than anything else, I think it's a pragmatic gesture to look at her life and say, well, this is what we have and there's really good things about it. And there's bad things about what other people have. But, you know, I think the readers, because we have a different life, no matter what our age and experience, our lives are very different. We're not in this world. I think they're able to do that.
Okay, so we'll move on. But because that was good. That was a good final point. I just want to say one thing. This is eligible for the Aurealis next year?
Yes, both these books will be. And I really would hope to see it in the children's section. In the shortlist.
I always say this shit, having read like three books. So what the fuck would I know?
If it's not there, you're going to quit the podcast.
Yeah. This is a pretty damn fine novel.
It is. It is a really good book. And as I said, like I love the voice of it. I love the pacing of it. And I love Peone. She's just fierce and she's...
Let's end on a cliche. She's a memorable character.
She's a real... But she feels real.
You're right.
But, you know, like what she has is she's got this ferocity about life and what she wants. I mean, that whole trek that she does home when she runs away from the city and almost dies because she just wants to get back to her family and the life that she likes. And, you know, she feels it's really important to be a bee. She knows the importance of the role that she has. She hasn't perhaps yet put all the pieces together about the unfairness of the role that she has, considering how important it is in the food supply. But, you know, she has pride in what the bees do and what she wants to do and what the farm does. And I think you see glimmers of a political awakening even at that young age in her. And I think she's going to be awesome when she's an adult.
Yes.
Stop looking at your phone. No, I can't believe it's the last podcast.
No, I'm setting up for the next book.
What is the next book?
It's the winner of the Ampersand Award.
Yes, we said that at the top.
So I don't think there's a back cover blurb on that one.
Well, it's very, 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 very short. It's just
so how about I read the one on Goodreads?
Okay, you do that.
Right, so that's very long. So, yes, In the Dark Spaces by Kelly Black. The latest winner of the Ampersand Prize is a genre-smashing kidnapping drama about... What does that mean?
Genre smashing?
Yeah, what the fuck does that mean?
I think that's a mainstream publisher trying to say we're publishing spec fic cooties, but give it a chance.
I'm just... Okay, yes, okay, I get that. But
that's what I think that is.
But genre smashing.
Because it's science fiction. This book is science fiction. It's core science fiction.
Like, it's taken the genre and it's just smashed the shit out of it.
That's a way for lit publishers to say, please read this book even though there's spaceships and aliens. We've not put them on the cover.
Okay, so it's a...
Cat Sparks refers to this phenomenon as genre taint.
Taint as in which definition of taint?
Oh, just like... Oh, I'm going to point that out to her. It has a taint.
Yeah,
to it, right?
Specfic has a taint.
So yeah. It's not taken as seriously. It's not regarded as well as mainstream literature. I mean, she's looking at cli-fi, but I think the term applies to stuff like this. It's genre smashing, right? It's not science fiction. It's genre smashing.
This is unabashedly. There's no. Yeah.
It's core science fiction. It's aliens and spaceships and absolutely science fiction.
The latest winner of the Ampersand Prize is a genre-smashing kidnapping drama about Tamara, who's faced with an impossible choice when she falls for her captors. Yet this is no... Actually, that should just end there. But I'm not going to end there. Yet this is no ordinary kidnapping. Tamara has been living on a freighter in deep space, and her kidnappers are terrifying crow people, the only aliens humanity has ever encountered. No one has ever survived a crow people attack until now, and Tamara must use everything she has just to stay alive. But survival always comes at a price. And there's no handbook for this hostage crisis. As Tamara comes to know the crow people's way of life and the threats they face from humanity's exploration into deep space, she realises she has an impossible choice to make. Should she stay as the only human among the crows, knowing she'll never see her family again, or inevitably betray her new community if she wants to escape? I'll leave that go. But you know what it doesn't mention? One of the key points.
What's that?
That when she's kidnapped, her brother...
Her cousin. But he's a brother figure because she's on the freighter with her aunt, who's the mother figure because she's an orphan.
Yes. So her cousin, who's younger as well, toddler.
He doesn't talk because he's been taught to be quiet. Yes. Could probably be because, a talking
because we should
age.
Be, we should be, yes, they are stowaways.
Yes.
So they live in the vents and that sort of thing and crawl between them to, anyway. But that's
well, they live in her aunt's cabin.
Yes, but they...
But Tamara does crawl through the vents to you know, steal and stuff.
And they have been caught by captains and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it doesn't mention that the cousin is alone on this freighter.
Yeah.
And that's actually one of the big raison d'etre of the novel.
It's her driving motivation.
Yes,
to survive and get back to her cousin, who as we say, is like in terms of the relationship, he's like a little brother.
Yeah.
Like a baby brother.
Anyway.
Yeah. And that's like drawn all the way through the book. Like she never forgets about...
Never.
I can't even remember his real name because she calls him Gub. All the way through,
but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, all the way through the book is like she has to get back to Gub. She has to do this because she has to survive.
Between the two books, in that there's Peony as well has a driving motivation to go home.
Yeah.
And never forgets home. In a lot of the stories that How to Be sort of mimics when X person is taken out of their their environment into a different environment, they usually become normalized in that new environment and they never go back to the old. But in both these books. The main character is about getting back home, because home
emblem, or back to family.
Family, yeah, well, yes, you're right, actually. Yeah. It's not home. Well, yeah, and we could argue that home and family are synonymous. But anyway, that's it.
Yeah, you could.
Getting back to family, because that's where that's their thing. And it's everyone's thing, to be fair. But, so even though they especially in the case of Tamara, they become part of the new society that they're in, it never changes. She never stops thinking about Gub. She never stops thinking about... And also, not just that, she never stops thinking about the violence she's seen and the bad things that have happened. She never entirely normalizes all that's happened around
because
her.
Because this, like this...
I love that. I really appreciate that. It's so easy just to go, well, yeah, the crow people.
Exciting new world.
Correct.
Yeah.
And just forget about it.
Yeah. But the thing is, it's not...
like most portal fantasies, I should say.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And every time she's in a really, really horrible... play and like by horror, like a psychologically and emotionally awful place. She always thinks about Gub and it's like, well, I need to do this. I need to get through this because I've got to get back to Gub. He might be alone. He doesn't have his family, you know, all of this sort of stuff. But at the same time, she is bonding with some of the crow people who are, you know, the aliens. And the aliens are awesome. Like, I really loved these aliens. You have to put a, you know, clearly, they're still very anthropomorphized and so on, but within those parameters, they're quite a different society.
So why'd you yell at me about feathers?
Because they're not called feathers. Why do everyone thinks they have feathers? They're like bats. I think it's because they're called crow people.
Yes, and also certain that cover is meant to mimic feathers.
I say I looked at that as a hive. It's very abstract, though. But no, their wings are like leathery and stuff. They're more. I pictured kind of bats, but no, a lot of people apparently think they have feathers.
Okay, sorry, Brent.
So it's weird. It's like I'm I don't sorry. Know whether the name the crow people, and they're called the crow people because of the armor that they wear. The helmet they have on has a very long sort of beakish protrusion. But they have wings. But the wings, as I said, are like their skin, they're leathery. They're more like bat wings than bird wings, and certainly there's no feathers. But for some reason, this thing like just sticks in readers' heads. It's really interesting.
So I've got to say that I took a little bit of time to get into this one, whereas How to Be is just immediately engaging. This one, not as for the first 20 or so pages, but then it's fantastic and I had no issue. Although...
Yes.
It's a direct copy.
Oh, here we go.
Of Nnedi Okorafor's Binti.
Is it? I've not read Binti.
It's like page. It's plagiarism.
Oh, is it really?
No, it's not. But Binti does have a very similar in as much as main character is not a stowaway on a ship. She's actually running away from her family to go to a university out in the galaxy. There's a special university out there for all smart kids. She goes on, so she's got an invitation to go, so she's right to be on the ship she's on, but the ship gets boarded by aliens.
Yep.
Everyone is slaughtered but her.
Right.
Okay, so same as this. And she befriends the aliens, even though they've gone and killed literally her and everyone she loves knows. Well, not her family, but the people she's become close to on the ship.
Yep.
And she becomes the translator / intermediary for those aliens because, again, they also have a strange language. And when they finally arrive at the university, because the ship's still going there, and it's also got a ship that's organic. Right. Not the alien ship, the ship that she's acting. But anyway, when they finally get there, she acts as that sort of go-between between the two, the cultures. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, so basically a, you know, scene by scene change.
Scene by
you know,
scene,
so, I couldn't help but think of Binti the whole way through.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Binti was published in 2015, so.
So what are you saying?
I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying.
That is basically the plot of In the Dark Spaces, I guess. Yes, no, because Tamara or Weku, as she's called by the crow people later.
Say that again?
Weku.
Okay.
What?
No, that's fine. I thought you mumbled it. That's all.
No. So she's taken because they speak in a language that is around whistles and breathing and things like that. And she, the reason she isn't killed immediately, A, she's a child. And we find out later that is important.
No, you know why? Because she uses their language.
But also she's a child because they say later, like, we're not savages. We don't. Yeah, because when she's trying to find out if they killed Gub.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And they say, well, we're not savages. We wouldn't kill children.
Yeah. I think that relates to Gub, though. I don't know if it related to her so much. Because
yeah, maybe not.
She's, what, 15, 16?
Yeah, true.
I really think she would have been blown away if she hadn't have said, you know, the
she mimics their language,
which is
and says the name of the one she assumes to be their leader,
yeah,
which is Tutupni.
Yeah.
So they take her on board to kind of, I guess they're curious. But I think it's because she's not a threat. I think if, like, you know, a big burly human with guns had done it, that he would have been blown away anyway, right? They would have gone, that was weird. He said
her name. But they kill the whole crew. They kill everyone.
Yeah.
Including her auntie, who's not a threat.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't buy it. I think that's not. It's because she uses their language.
It is, but what I'm saying is I think if, like, a big burly human with guns had used their language, he wouldn't have been taken on board.
All right, fine. It's
a bit of both.
So using the language is a necessary but not sufficient condition for survival against the
I think people. It's what I'm saying, okay. Yes. So she's taken aboard their ship, and it's an organic ship. That made me think of Moya in Farscape, actually. Except this ship, the Hive ship, which it's referred to as, sustains the crow people as well. It gives them nourishment, and they feed the ship. So they go through space getting these minerals, which feed the ship,
another theme that's similar, ecology, yeah,
and
environment.
And in turn, the ship feeds them and nurtures them and keeps them warm and all this sort of stuff. And they have a very beyond socialist society, actually, because socialism is still pitted against capitalism, and their society doesn't function like that.
Well, it's hierarchical, though, because they've got a council of elders.
Yeah, what's that got to do with money?
Money. No, but if you say a pure socialist society, a pure universalist society would be flat. It wouldn't have hierarchy. It wouldn't be hierarchical.
Yeah, but in terms of distribution of resources and stuff.
Well, it'd still be flat, though.
In terms of distribution of resources.
There is a leadership group that determines.
They are, but they don't get more stuff. Like everyone, like all the resources are communal and combined.
All right, I'll tell you what. We'll read, was it Das Kapital when we're. when we're not doing the podcast and see who, you know.
I'm just saying, in terms of the resources and the distribution of resources, as opposed to power hierarchies, like in terms of military leadership and so on, because, you know, this ship is a ship that is going out. So we only see in this small part of the society, because we don't know about people who aren't on these Hive ships traveling around getting minerals, right? We these are all female, the crow people on the ship, because they're more efficient to be in space, all this sort of stuff. So we don't know about how the society functions when they're not traveling through space. We've just got this wedge of it. But certainly in terms of resources, it's not like, you know, the ship's executive all get all the food and all the good stuff.
No, you're right.
Right. Everything is distributed as according to need. Like it's like the definition of pure socialism. Everything is just distributed according to need. No one gets more than anything else if it's not needed.
Although,
you know,
doesn't Tutupede, and I pronounced that wrong, get a slightly get a slightly bigger room on essentially an office, because she's got all the
she has an
trophies.
Office because she's because she is the military commander, so she does need, but she needs that. It's not like she's got this massive suite and a four-poster bed, yeah, equivalent, you know, like this is what I mean. Like everything is just when Tamara or Weku is trying to explain, and there's a language difficulty, but there's also a conceptual difficulty trying to explain how human society works with the class structure and poverty, and because one of the big things about the world building in this, in the human side of stuff, is the fact that people are working on these freighter ships, which go out mining minerals, ending up being the same minerals that the crow people need for survival.
Yeah.
They're mined and sent back to Earth for the rich people to you know, get wealthy.
Yes.
But the people working and living on these ships and they're a centrifugal gravity thing. So if you live on the rim of the ship, if you live on level 6, you've got pretty much Earth gravity, and but you're wealthy if you live there. That's, you know, the good. Everyone else gets further and further towards the centre and less gravity. So their muscles are physically wasted. Yeah. So they not only can they financially not get ahead because they're not paid enough to actually do anything more than just kind of keep living.
Even if they were to get ahead, they'd be physically ruined.
That's it. Even if they financially were somehow able to save enough money to go back to Earth, they couldn't even live on Earth.
Correct.
Or another planet. They just couldn't. It's this really horrendous. They're indentured. They're not even indentured servants. They're pretty much indentured slaves at this point. And they're trapped in this cycle of. And so Tamara is trying to explain how this works and how money works. Because the Crow people don't have money. They've got no concept of, like, why would you have this weird thing that
She says to them, there is a better way. You don't have to kill everyone. You could trade.
Yes.
And the whole concept of trade is alien to them.
Yes, because the concept of money is alien. Because the concept of putting prices on things and some people not getting food that they need because they can't afford it.
Yes.
And then Crow people are like, what? What kind of savage society do you live in? Which is true, right? The fact that we have people who starve to death in a world where millions and millions of tons of food are disposed of every year. And we have people literally starving to death on this planet.
Yes.
Like, it is disgraceful. We do not manage our affairs well as human beings. And then this is the kind of thing she's trying to explain to the Crow people, and they are horrified.
Yeah, but
they're really smart.
Tamara,
so they work out trade pretty well.
But Tamara has to do quite a bit in this book. She has to learn a language and then explain capitalism.
And then teach the language to the captain
because the captain is captured.
Yes.
Who's a great character, by the way.
Yes, he's really good.
Really sympathetic, beautifully done. Because also he's emblematic of, hey, I'm just doing a job here. I'm not actually trying to further the empire or anything.
Yeah, I'm just trying to send money back home to my kids.
Correct. Yes, I've got my own. And I'm old. I should have retired.
Yeah.
I don't need to be doing... Well, I do need to be doing this, but I shouldn't have to be doing this.
Yeah.
So, lay off, Crow people. Understand that we're not all part of... Well, we're cogs. We're not...
Again, there's a complexity to this.
Well, that's right. He's saying, I'm a cog. I'm not really an agent... with my own free choice. No one, actually the only person who does.
And I have no authority to negotiate anything.
Correct.
Like, there's no point asking me to do, I have not, I'm driving a ship.
But she has to teach him how to speak the language so that he can potentially become that.
And this is one of these, like, I really like books.
By the way, that's different to Binti. That doesn't happen in Binti.
Right, okay. there we go. Well, that's the small bit that makes it not plagiarism. But this is one of these books that I really love that not enough books and movies do, whereas they show you how capable a character is instead of just telling you or having other characters say, you're so smart. Because Tamara learns the Crow people's language through listening to them and mimicry and asking, like, as she gets where she can ask what other things are and all this sort of stuff. So she teaches herself and she is young. So there is that, because the younger you are, the more... able you are to learn language. But when the captain comes on and Tatupni gives Tamara the job of teaching him the language so then the captain can talk to him directly.
By the way, with the threat that if she doesn't learn 25 new words, she'll what? Cut off her...
he doesn't get food for a day. Anyway, so... And then we see how hard it is for him to learn the language. So then you realise then, Tamara's really smart. Like, to not only learn it, but to teach herself and pick it up really quickly. So you get that juxtaposition. So instead of just, like...
Do you think she's too smart?
No, I don't think she's too smart. I think she's really savvy.
For the convenience of the novel?
She's smart, and she's really savvy. But the thing is, she wouldn't be the protagonist of this novel if she wasn't, because of how she's had to live.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? She would have been found out and kicked off a freighter years before if she wasn't smart and savvy. She wouldn't actually be in this position. If she wasn't already smart. It's not like they accidentally got the smartest kid on the ship, because she's the only kid on the ship. And she's the only kid on the ship because she's smart and she has really good survival skills and she thinks quickly and she's strategic. That's why she's still there at age 15 or 16, however old she is. So, yeah. So, no, I think that's quite organically shaped. And she's not, it's not as though she has watched some Earth documentaries and things. But it's not like she's got heaps of book learning and, like, Kelly Black hasn't taken that shortcut to say, oh, she's read a lot of stuff and therefore... No, like, all her
it's street smarts. In
all her knowledge and everything is really hard won. and her ability to think really quickly and assess a situation and find the best way out of it or the best way through it has come from years of living illegally on these freighters.
But for all that, the book doesn't make it easy because Tamara, and I'm just going to keep calling it Tamara,
okay.
Constantly puts her in a position where she has to portray someone. She's always having...
Yeah.
Initially she has to portray humanity because she lures people out. Like they attack another freighter. They lure people out through her and then kill the captains and the crew.
Initially she didn't know that was going to happen. She did actually think she was going to be able to translate between the crew people and the next freighter but the crew people kind of used her to lure them out. Although to be fair, they kind of didn't come out, so...
Well, yeah, but still, that is the intent.
Yeah.
And then when she does get back to humanity.
To another freighter, ship.
She escapes the crow people.
Yeah.
Because although she...
So she kind of betrays them. And that results in the death of Tweetu, who was her big sister / mother figure on the hive ship.
And that's just... That's brutal. Just brutal and upset. That doesn't happen in Bindi either.
No, this book is absolutely brutal. It really is. It doesn't pull. There's a good interview on ABC National Radio that's online at the moment. I'll link to that where Callie Black talks about this book and how her first draft of this, she wrote it just for herself, just for fun. And for fun, for Bren, seems to be as dark and bleak and cynical as possible. And it was much worse. When it won the Ampersand Prize, they back engineered a lot more optimism and tenderness and hope into this book. Because can you imagine how awful it must have been?
given the first 15 pages has an entire ship being slaughtered.
But yeah, so you can just imagine how dark and bleak this book was before it.
Well, maybe spoilers, the captain really does die.
Maybe he really does, I don't know.
And it all ends in one big conflagration humanity and the crow people are just wiped off the...
But I do like the ending. I think the ending is, quite optimistic.
Well, the ending does something that Hadaby doesn't do, although might be suggests. The ending sets up a possible utopia.
Well, an alternative.
Sorts. Well, it's... No, but... It's science fiction, so let's talk language of utopias.
Yep, okay.
Because science fiction does play in that ballpark, and that's what it's doing. It's saying, let's see if we can combine the two societies together, one that's outright capitalist, one that's socialist, and find a happy medium between the two. Although it's clear that the human side of it is moving towards the crow people side because... Yeah. Anyway, but it is that interesting idea of integrating two different cultures and putting forward this idea that this is a workable society.
Yeah.
So it is a utopia.
Well, I mean, it's a suggestion of utopia. Yes. Right? Well, that's what I mean. I think it's an alternative, but because I mean, like, we haven't really talked about it, but the other theme that runs through this book when you talk about. The humans coming and invading a space and taking resources and not understand is colonization and invasion and all of this stuff and
they're just taking the minerals. They're not taking people's culture.
Because this is the minerals that the crow people need literally to survive. They're not minerals that the earth people take back to buy trinkets. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
Like this is the stuff that the ship lives on, and in turn the ship sustains the aliens. If these minerals are, and this is why they're pushing further out, because the humans have taken the minerals. And again, the way the crow people sort of gather them is in a much more sustainable way, because they only take what they need to feed the ship. The humans come in and take the lot. So it's this idea of well, we live sustainably and we live as we need to and we take what we need, whereas you guys come and just rape and pillage and it's all gone and there's nothing. So of course we're going to kill you because what you're doing is starving us. What you're doing is killing our culture. You're killing it via, not military genocide, but you're killing it because you are killing us. And if there's no us, there's no culture. So, I mean, I think the parallels are really strong because it's not, and I'm not saying it like, of course there is, violence and bloodshed and military style attempted genocides everywhere. And that is part of colonization and always has been. But there's also the other side of colonization, where you do destroy people in less obvious and violently extreme methods, and then you can say your hands are a bit cleaner. So, but your hands are not clean.
No, look, you're right, and it's in that sense it's a very layered and very smart.
Yeah, book. And you do get on the side of the aliens. Like, I'm totally on the side of the aliens by the end of the book, because they are. I mean, yes, they have a very brutal and pragmatic solution to the invading forces that are coming in and taking what they need to just to live.
Well, the fact, well, yeah.
But that leads to a very pragmatic solution.
They don't even think of negotiation. It's not even a thought that goes through their heads.
No, because because conceptually it doesn't exist. I mean, there's nothing, like Tamara has to go to a lot of trouble to explain concepts trade and ownership.
They're treating humanity as if it was a virus. You don't negotiate with the virus, you just destroy it.
Well, you know, if you're growing food and your beetles come in and start eating all your tomatoes, you don't negotiate with the beetles those two bushes and leave me there. You just kill all the beetles,
right?
Yeah,
and again, that's why they keep Tamara alive, because she's shown an adaptness to their language, which they clearly didn't think was even possible.
Yeah.
They've not conceptualized this idea that whatever these humans are could even speak their speak.
Because no one has before.
Yes.
I mean, no one on either side has ever really tried to communicate.
Yeah, I mean, you do. You can't help it. And it's another book where you can't stand humanity. Except the captain comes in and he's very... I mean, Tamara, obviously, but the captain provides another viewpoint.
I think, again, it's a book where there aren't... except maybe for like the captain at the very end, who's really, but even he, I mean, again, his motives are really understandable, right? In terms of like he wants to say,
and his soldiers who insult Tamara, you know, and call her a traitor and things like that. But then that's what
is understandable, right?
Because she has done the things that they say she's done.
I think
whether knowingly or not,
both books are really they're really careful about talking about the evils and the problems of systems and structures, and not pointing to individual people and saying that person there, that one, that's the problem, that's the evil, because that's not true, and it's not true on Earth, because there's not one person, well, except maybe there is now, but you know, where if you dispense with them, the world would be a bit better.
Even
you know,
in
people
that case.
just step in, right? It's the structures and the systems and everything that needs to be changed. It's not looking at individual people. I mean, individual people do the wrong things and they do bad things and things need to be corrected on an individual level as well, but that's not sufficient. It's not sufficient to say that person did that bad thing, put them in jail. That person did that bad thing, take their stuff away. You have to dismantle systems. And both of these books, I think, are really good at pointing to the inherent injustice in systems. And the fact that some people are better off under other systems, and they're going to be more resistant to changing that because they will lose stuff. You know, so there is this lovely balance between pointing to individual accountability, but also acknowledging that it's the larger system that provides that opportunity for individual wealth building and greed and blind eye turning and all that sort of stuff. And I think they both do that really well.
I agree. I think these are two great books to to end this podcast, because they sum up everything about the podcast.
Oh, do they?
No, not really. But no, I mean that they're great fiction. And I should say, we've been quite earnest about the two books. They're really good books. I mean, as you know, qua novels, they are really, really enjoyable reads. Miserable, depressing and violent, but still... Well, they're actually not miserable. How to Be is not miserable at all. And there's even a lighter tone to In the Dark Places.
They're
gripping.
They are. And I think like a lot of that comes from, as I said, both books are told in the first person. We haven't spoken as much about the language of In the Dark Spaces, but there's also an idiosyncratic voice to Tamara's narrative.
Yeah, the usual portmanteaus, fabricated language.
Different languages brought in
and it's done really well. It doesn't push you out of the narrative.
No, but you get the sense that you are listening to people talk. You know what I mean? It's not just a you're just reading a narrative. You're listening to someone telling you their story. And that pulls you in. And both those characters, both Peony and Tamara, are, you know, their resilience is admirable and realistic. Humans are incredibly resilient. And I don't think we acknowledge that enough. So no matter what awful situations you put us in, we kind of just keep living. Very few of us actually curl up into a ball and die. Like we just manage to. I mean, you can say horrible things about human beings, and you can, and what we do, and how rapacious we are. But we're fucking resilient, and that's, I guess, how we've gotten to the situation we're in, it in some extent. But yeah, no, I love these characters, both of them. They don't say die. They don't give up no matter what. And it's awesome.
So that's it.
That's it. Highly recommended. I expect to see both these books somewhere on awards list next year. I'd really love to see How to Be on the Children's Book Council of Australia awards list.
Oh, yes, there's that too, yeah, isn't there?
I think it's such a good book.
I'd like to see them both.
Both of them, actually.
I like to see them both get internationally recognised, because How to Be has a very strong Australian
flavour.
How to
Be has just been picked up to be published in the UK. So,
oh, great. Well, no, well, because really I raise that because How to Be is quite, it's a Melbourne book. Mm. It's Golden Valley, isn't it? I think. Anyway,
I can't remember if it's, like, I don't think it's actually specifically
said. No, I think it is.
Said.
I think it is.
Okay.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is they have, they're not too idiosyncratically Australian, if that. Which sounds like cultural cringe.
Well, in the dark space, certainly, isn't it? It's set in space.
Yeah.
I mean, that's right. It. Well, there's no nationality there.
In the dark space, it should be picked up by all the publishers.
All of them, everywhere.
And How to Be Sure too, as well. And I'm glad it's been sold into the UK.
Yeah, I'm not sure when it's being published there, or even if I don't think it already has been, but it's certainly been, the UK rights have been sold. So it will be in the UK soon. I'm not sure about the US, but yeah, both of these books are really good, and I hope they get wider recognition. And that's it.
Yeah, so we're done. Bye. So is there anything you want to say or do?
Well, I just want to thank everyone who has listened to us over the past 7 years.
Fuck me.
I know, it's such a long time. And I especially want to thank all the people who have been patrons through Patreon for the past couple of years.
And who have written to us in the last few
weeks. And everyone who's contacted us either on Twitter or email. We really appreciate it, guys. And I'm going to close the Patreon account now after this podcast. So, but we do thank you. That's been great. And we've used a bit of that money to replace equipment over the years. And we're going to kind of use what's left to keep this podcast alive where it currently lives for a bit longer.
Two of our German fans harangued Rob Shearman.
I know.
Trying to force him to convince me to keep the podcast going. Well, that didn't work. I did speak to Rob,
maybe,
I should say.
Maybe.
They did make an attempt. He did make an attempt.
Maybe if they'd kidnapped him and put him in a space freighter. And
yeah, that's true. Then we might have. We might have
kept going.
Yeah.
But no.
He did make a Rob attempt. You know, he said, well,
excellent,
you could keep it going. I said, yeah, no, we're not though. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, that's
hey, maybe if he wrote a story every month.
Let's not give Rob more work. No. But you know, it's been very nice for people
awesome.
To say the things that they've said. I mean, it's made me feel really happy.
Yeah, no, we really, really appreciate it every time we hear from someone. And as I said, thank you for those people who were able to sponsor us on Patreon.
Yes, thank you.
That made the last couple of years a bit easier in terms of equipment failure and being able to replace it.
There is a possibility, although it won't be face-to-face, that we'll do a couple of episodes next year.
We might do. We might, for example, do an Aurealis one again.
Yes, I'm thinking that's one.
Unless, you know, the books that win are books we've already discussed, and then I could just cobble together those two episodes.
So, no, look, I'd like to thank
a clip show.
I'd like to thank my wife.
Oh, for letting you come and podcast.
Yeah, basically. I mean, we've been in Ballarat. Well, you've been in Ballarat. It's been a 5-6 hour chunk of time. So
yes.
That's very nice of her. I'd like to thank you.
Oh.
Because I really should have bought you something, but...
Did you? No.
No.
Not even a coffee.
Because you've done all the work, frankly. I just turn up and speak.
Yeah. I have one more podcast to produce and stuff, and then I'm done. Oh, my God.
And you do make... Because I do speak too close to the mic, and so you do get rid of most of the crackles.
I
have listened to some of the podcasts.
Have you?
Yeah.
Have you? Yeah.
And look, it's going to be a bit of a hole in my life. But look, I will say this though, I'm blogging again on my blog.
Yes, and you're pre-blogging on Twitter.
Yeah, which is pretty stupid. But do you know Twitter are introducing Twitter Storm threading?
Well, is that like Storifying, but now Twitter's doing it?
Yeah, so what it means, so what I have to do at the moment, so yes, I write my first drafts on Twitter.
Yes.
Which then get put on my blog. And they are terrible. They are mostly nonsensical. But what I have is I've got to keep replying to the same thing. And you miss one or blah, 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 you know. And so the thread goes kaput. No, now they're making it a lot easier where you can press a plus button and it allows
and
you to
seam them together.
Yeah, and if you stop and then come back, it says, do you want to add a tweet to this thread? And yeah.
Big shout out to Twitter.
Yeah. Where's the sponsorship money? We keep going for another year if they gave us that.
My God, right in the critics, sponsored by Twitter.
Twitter, yeah.
No, don't even put that out there. No.
So yes, there's that. But I also recommend another podcast that might fill the writer and the critic hole in your life.
What's that?
So it comes out fortnightly. It's not genre, although they do genre books. In fact, they just did an episode about Diana Wynne Jones, Fire and Hemlock. It's a podcast called Backlisted, B-A-C-K-L-I-S-T-E-D.
I have not heard about this.
Comes
one.
Out fortnightly. It's one of the podcasts. It's Andy Miller and John, I've forgotten his second name, who runs Unbound. You know Unbound Books?
Yep.
He's the publisher for Unbound Books. And they have guests in, like Una McCormack and just other people who come in. They did a fantastic Shirley Jackson episode.
Oh, I need to go and look that
one
up.
Yeah, you really should listen to that one.
Okay.
But they also do, you know.
Oh, we could do a special Shirley Jackson Awards episode.
Anyway.
I'm just not comfortable ending on 68. It just doesn't feel right.
I can see that. Anyway, Backlisted do a fortnightly podcast where they do one book. And it's the whole point of it is that they pick an author who's essentially been not forgotten. Well, in some cases forgotten or underrated.
Okay.
All right. So there's a lot of UK authors you've never heard of.
Nice. I like that idea. I like the idea of doing older books.
They also have pommy accents, which is far easier to listen to than us, I'll be honest.
Oh, that you're
well, me
so...
anyway. No, me anyway. No, because there's it's just so such a pleasure to listen to it. And they're funny.
Oh, my goodness.
What? It's not cultural cringe.
Yes, it is.
Listen to the high pitch of
it
my voice
so
now.
It is so cultural cringe.
How can anyone listen to this for 7 years?
So cultural cringe. Oh, my goodness me.
I don't have a good podcast voice in my view. Whereas the Andy Miller in particular, it just sounds like molten chocolate lava.
Okay. Maybe you can...
And they're very smart and well-read and it's really good. And they get a lot of guests in and yes.
Cool.
So
excellent.
Backlisted, I highly, highly recommend. I've only just started listening to it myself, but I highly recommend it.
Excellent. I will find that and put a link to it in the show notes because I too am interested in that because, wow, I have like 12 hours a month that I can refill with something now.
Yeah. And each episode goes for about 55 minutes. So if you... And it's fortnightly, so it's like two
nice.
Books in a month.
It is.
For about the length.
It's exactly the same as The Writer and the Critic.
Why are we going for this long? We could have just said, hey, go to Backlisted. They do the same job.
Awesome.
So there's that.
Well.
Do you have anything else to add?
No. Just thank you again to everyone who's listened and the people who've been on our podcast over the years.
Oh, my God, we had
which we've done less and less since we moved to Ballarat. But, yes, we did have some lovely authors. And thank you to Continuum who allowed us to be live podcasting for a few years there. And it's been fun. I'm really glad we did this. I can't believe it's been 7 years.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I really can't believe it's been 7 years.
No, I'm sure it's been 7 years.
Yeah, you looked it up. It's there. The internet does not lie.
I genuinely thought we started in 2013, and I don't know why I thought that.
No, 2010.
Yeah,
which is the year I got married. I should have remembered that.
And it's the year my son was born. Wow. So we have been podcast. In fact,
that was a busy year.
In fact, to end off, he was 5 months old.
Wow. We've been podcasting for almost your son's entire life.
I know.
Maybe we should keep going until he's 18. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. And we may see you again in the future.
It's been an honour and a pleasure.
Yes. Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.
I just wanted to make sure it wasn't the deck because that got wet too. If it was the deck, we couldn't record. But it's just the headphones, so it's just what I'm hearing. That's okay.
You cannot. Because
remember that time it got
you
wet?
You cannot keep blaming me for it getting wet. There was no water
was
in the garage.
It was in your garage.
Nothing around it was wet.
Where did you go and piss on it then? Because it got moisture. There was an inch of liquid in the bottom of the case when it came back to me.
On the bloody. You think I got up one night and said, I don't know where the toilet is. I'm just going to walk, open the garage and urinate.
Maybe you did. Well, if there was no water in the garage, liquid came from somewhere.
Mind you, that's some good aiming.
That is some good aiming. Like right through the crack in the case there.